I think if you look back at lung cancer, you might want to pinpoint Tom's paper, 2004 New England Journal, among several data sets that came out looking at EGFR mutations. It's funny because I actually met Tom 2 weeks before the paper was published. We were doing an interview, and I got to the point, I said, well, you know, of course, in those days, we had no clue, you know, just like we do with Bev right now, or don't with Bev right now, how to predict. And I said, anything on the horizon, his face got all red, and he said, I can't talk about it. And I'm like, what? You can't talk about it. And 2 weeks later, he was on Good Morning America or whatever talking about it. Anyhow, so that's just 6 years ago, Tom, you know, 6 years ago. And I mean, lung cancer in a way has kind of almost leaped ahead of a lot of other cancers. Tom, you made an intriguing comment about biopsy at relapse. And in breast cancer, there's like five or six presentations at this meeting. There's been a whole thing in breast cancer about markers as people go through the course of their illness. What do we know about that in non-small cell? Do we see changes?
Well, I think the driver mutation will still be there. So the fundamental EGFR mutation will still be there. But for example, in looking at EGFR mutants, trying to determine what is responsible for progression, whether it's a T790M mutation, whether it's MET amplification, which would lead to different clinical trials you might want to look for your patient, that I think is something you would see differently at the time of relapse. Vince, you presented a terrific paper at ASCO last year on this. You may want to comment.
Well, I think patients are very open to it. At this point, I don't think it can be considered standard in, say, a community-based practice, but certainly it drives a whole portfolio of clinical trials that people like myself and Tom and Passiani and others do that are geared to drugs and specific mechanisms, MET inhibitors, drugs that are second-generation TKIs, etc., and many other mechanisms that are going to come to the fore in the coming months and years.
Tom, what about so-called irreversible TKIs? I know there's a BIBW compound. There's a bunch of others. How do they work? Maybe you can get a little bit to the T790 thing also.
So we think about half the resistance that we see to EGFR TKIs is due to a secondary mutation called T790M. And again, much of this data comes from Vince's team at Memorial. And there are some drugs which are being designed which preclinically appear to have some benefit against tumors harboring the T790M mutation. And these are two drugs, one from Pfizer, one from Boehringer Ingelheim. They're in advanced stages of development and advanced stages of clinical trials, specifically looking at seeing whether or not they benefit patients in the setting of having progressed, but also maybe they're better up front. You know, again, just like I think giving the best therapy up front makes sense, giving therapy that prevents emergence of resistance could make sense. And so trying to figure out whether either compound up front makes more sense also is going to be valid in looking at these compounds and looking at these agents.
Are there any clinical data right now that would maybe be encouraging patients who progressed on a, I guess, non or irreversible EGFR TKI?
There are some cases of patients who've responded, but the data is not. In fact, John Charles and I were involved with a trial of a similar compound where there were a handful of responses, all in France. I don't know why we didn't get responses in the U.S. They were all in France.
Because of wine.
Because of what?
Of wine.
Of wine. Okay.
Chandra, what about gefitinib? Is that theoretically as active as erlotinib? What do we know comparatively? Will it ever come back on the market, for example, in the United States?
I think that's a very good question. EGFR mutation-positive patients probably need a little bit of the dose of the EGFR TKI. Based on the pharmacokinetics, we do know that the approximate dose of gefitinib, if you compare it to 150 milligrams of erlotinib, is close to 700 milligrams of gefitinib. So you would have to give three times the dose of gefitinib in order to get that benefit, what you get with erlotinib. But in mutation-positive patients, it probably doesn't really matter because you can probably get away with giving 50 milligrams of erlotinib as you give only 250 milligrams. And 250 milligrams of gefitinib actually has much less toxicity. And that's why in the Eastern world, it has really taken off. So I think EGFR mutation-positive patients, gefitinib should also be approved in the Western world. The EMEA has approved it in Europe at a 250 milligram dose based on both the European studies and the IPAS study. So I think, yes, it needs a comeback in mutation-positive patients only.
Well, I think you could even extend the argument. When we had gefitinib years ago and it was approved, it came with conditions. One of those conditions was the INTEREST trial that compared gefitinib to docetaxel, and it was not inferior to docetaxel, and therefore I think that it should be an option. I think to have two TKIs, it would be a little bit of market-based competition. I think that would be good for patients.
One final question back to Tom. What about the issue of just, you mentioned the term oncogene addiction. To what extent do you think that model applies in lung cancer and in cancer specifically? A lot of our research seems to be sort of trailing after that model. 10 years from now, is that going to have a big public health impact, or are we just looking at a small part of cancer?
So I think this is a great unknown. I think oncogene addiction, or the idea that one driver oncogenic mutation is driving the cancer, is something which my gut tells me will probably be a handful of lung cancer, not most lung cancer. The big change now, as we enter what will soon be the post-genome world, will be in the future, when Neil has this meeting in 2 years, we'll be talking about how do we handle the results from whole genome sequencing from your patients. And patients will come into your office with a thumb drive, which will have their whole genome sequence on it. And that thumb drive, you will not know what the heck to do with it, and none of us will know what the heck to do with it. But what you find in the initial 12 lung cancers that have been done at WashU, according to Dr. Govindan, some of these, which is a big genome center, some of these lung cancers have 1,200 mutations. Well, how do you figure out which ones are related to driving the cancer versus which ones are passenger mutations? And that's going to take us years to figure out what's next. So I think, Neil, there will be a subset of oncogene-addicted tumors, but there'll be a far greater number, because of tobacco, a far greater number of tumors which have hundreds of mutations or genetic abnormalities which will be present in them. And that will be the rest of our career and the rest of our kids' career to figure out for a broad number of cancers.
That's too long. It really is. It's too long. We've got to move up that timetable, but that may be a topic for another time.